Hey Rachel,
Hey, David.
what do you call the Rebel Alliance commander who feels tired?
I don't know, David.
General Malaise.
Ouch. I guess he puts the fatigue in fatigues. Welcome to Wizards and Spaceships, the podcast where we harsh your squee. Sci-fi and fantasy has always had an optimistic current, whether it's utopian space-age cities or noble chosen ones vanquishing a dark lord. In recent years, with the popularity of romanticism and cozy fantasy, it's easier than ever to immerse yourself in a more hopeful world. But what if instead we made you feel bad? With us to discuss the warring vibes in genre fiction is Nick Mamatas. Nick is an American horror, science fiction, and fantasy author and was editor for Haikusoru, a line of translated Japanese science fiction novels for Viz Media. Now he edits manga for Seven Seas Entertainment. His fiction has been nominated for a number of awards, including several Bram Stoker Awards. Most recently, he's the editor of the anthology 120 Murders, dark fiction inspired by the alternative era. Welcome to the show, Nick.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yep, good to see you.
First question, why do you hate fun? And follow-up question, why do you want us all to suffer?
I love fun. And if you're going to suffer, you may as well have some fun doing it. What I am suspicious of is psychotherapeutic mandated fun and psychotherapeutic mandated alleviation of suffering, especially when it's done by untrained, unlicensed psychotherapists, that is to say, novelists and fans. And I would say for the past 20 years or so, or even before that, right before I started in the field, actually, there's been a really strange folkloric psychotherapeutic current based on fanish folkways and homeopathy and common knowledge, in quotes. And a kind of a dubious, not kind of a, an especially dubious moral collapse of portrayal and advocacy that has made things first awful online, and then everyone who learned these things online grew up and entered the publishing industry.
Oh
Oh yes, that's right. So everyone from Fandom Wank now is an editor at a major publishing house. And has taken the Fandom Wank website lessons to heart as to what books look like and how they should be promoted and the dangers and problems of bad books, especially bad books by the bad gender, by which they mean boys. So those are my real issues. That is why I hate fun.
Yes, kind of the
Well,
Tumblrification of fantasy and sci-fi.
So one thing I wanted to ask you about is because this episode is called Against Hope Punk, and I was wondering what is Hope Punk and what is Grimdark? So if you can just talk about those two tendencies, what they're about.
Well, Hope Punk is a part of a long tradition of newer writers trying to publicize their material by making up a subgenre. This is a very long-lasting thing, of course, perhaps most famously for this crowd, China Mieville did it twice with The New Weird was the first one. And he made that up to promote his second, third, and fourth novels, the Boss Logic novels. And if you look at the New Weird Manifesto, he tries to tie his work and the work of a few antecedents, like M. John Harrison, to what at the time was the perspectives of the Socialist Worker Party of Great Britain, of UK. Which was that the Battle of Seattle was a big deal. The Battle of Seattle, for those who don't know, which is probably nobody given this podcast, was the 1999 protest against the World Trade Organization that won, a protest that won and did stuff. The SWP oriented heavily toward this, thinking it was going to take off and become a worldwide phenomenon. And anti-corporate globalization was won, but didn't have the impact that the SWP thought it would have until the Occupy movement 12 years later. So New Weird was that. Then he had Nuard, which was, do you remember that one?
I
New
don't.
puns, David. What is Nuard? No? Noir plus weird is Nuard.
Oh my God. I think I
Yeah.
completely missed that phase. I think there he did City in the City.
Yes, and that was to promote City and City, which was such a better book than the genre that he's trying to create, that it didn't matter that he had that this kind of thing. New Weird was a better concept than his books. His books were pretty good. The concept was so interesting. Noir, not that interesting a concept, but the book was so good he didn't need the concept. And this happened in the 80s. Bruce Sterling created Slipstream, which was half mainstream, half fantasy, but included a list of books that included Naked Lunch and The Princess Bride. And any list that puts those two books together is not a list that is any way comprehensible. And Rudy Rucker did this with transrealism, by which he meant his science fiction. And I even asked him one time, I said, Rudy, what is transrealism? I said, well, I published my first novel. It didn't really go anywhere, so I thought if I made up something interesting to talk about, people would talk about it. And this is Hope Punk. Hope Punk was created by a writer named Alex Rowland, sometimes bylined Alexandra Rowland, and they wrote what was essentially a manifesto in search of some books, or manifesto in search of a genre. And as far as I could tell, Hope Punk boiled down to, we really like Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And there's much to like in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but it was like, what if everything was like Buffy the Vampire Slayer? Wouldn't that be better for everyone morally? Because you could have your friends, and you could fight, and you could be kind of cool, and you won't necessarily win too much, because you have to keep fighting. And if you have a victory, you have to make some conclusions about society and solve some problems, but we can't do that. So we'll just keep at it, and there'll be these big bads coming every season, just like in Buffy. And what do they want? They want to be bad. And what motivates them? And can they be more complex? No, unless it's Spike, who's everybody's favorite. And so everyone influenced by one Buffy, but also by the fan fiction around Buffy, the fan fiction around Harry Potter, the fan fiction around Supernatural, kind of embraced this really incoherent notion of Hope Punk, which is found families that seem to be fighting back via supernatural powers and their semi-coolness, what nerds think is cool type of stuff, against incoherent evils that cannot be defeated, cannot be understood, and should not be thoroughly described in the so that you might make a Christian mistake, because Christianity has two moral innovations. One is that everyone can be forgiven, which is terrible, awful, because you can't forgive people who are your abusers. That's you being a sucker at best. And two, to love one's enemy, which is also shitty. You should only love your found family. And so you have this very strange reactionary morality that is even more reactionary than far-right Christianity, combined with a kind of goofy TV style writing of like the Joss Whedon, everyone's cracking jokes even as the world's ending and people are dying, etc. So that's what Hope Punk is. Grimdark is almost the opposite. Actually, there's also fan families, and there's also a morality that is more reactionary than even reactionary Christianity. And it purports to some kind of realism, like, oh well, you know, down in the tents of the warriors, when they're gathering up, they're definitely gonna fucking piss and they're gonna kill. Ha ha, look at that. Oh my gosh. Imagine killing somebody and having to look at it and wiping off your sword afterward. Isn't that awful? And by awful, don't we mean isn't that great? However, I will say that Grimdark at least has a wonderful exponent in Joe Abercrombie, whose novels are hysterical in that they're funny and hysterical in that they are a kind of hysterical realism with fantasy elements. So they're really over the top, overcharged sentences and circumstances, which is at least engaging because he is not part of the psychotherapeutic cult in publishing, and thus you're allowed to experience intense emotions.
Yeah. So what I'm getting from this is that in order to market my books, I should invent a subgenre.
Absolutely. Cold punk, you're in Canada.
Cold punk. Yes. I spawned.
Cold punk, there you go, right? Sorry punk.
Sorry?
You're sorry punk.
Story punk. Okay.
At
Yes.
least in America, Canadians are famous in America for saying they are sorry for everything. Is
Yeah.
that a joke up there?
We do absolutely do that.
Yeah. Sorry, Cora.
Okay. No, this is happening. I need some new marketing strategies. So, yeah. So, many people who enjoy escapism argue, and I do kind of agree with them, that in dark times, escape is necessary. And also, I don't know, consuming fiction isn't the same as doing something about these dark times. And for me, like reading or writing optimistic fiction in dark times often feels more like cruelty than escape.
Yeah.
So, what's the relationship between these vibe trends in writing and publishing and what happens out in the real world?
Oh, that's a good question. So first, I guess we should talk about escapism and escape, and there's always that little back and forth people have. Well, escapism is what the jailer wants you to be happy in your cell in your escapism. What you really want to do is escape the cell. But fiction isn't necessarily a vehicle for either of these things, or at least it's only a vehicle when readers make it so, and readers can make anything. As a creature of the 1990s, I acknowledge the existence of counter reads, which is part of why I'm very suspicious and skeptical of this claim that certain fictions are bad for you or are problematic. It really depends on how you read it. And we can see the obvious example is 1984 by George Orwell, which is explicitly anti-Stalinist, being claimed by everyone on Earth. Everyone thinks they are the Winston and everyone else is spying on them, which of course is also one of the themes of 1984. But so the far right loves 1984 and says, oh, Hillary Clinton was Big Sister and we don't want nobody spying on us. But also you want to do a lot of spying. You want to go into the IRS and look at your records and that kind of thing. So these are rhetorical bludgeons left around society for anyone to pick up. I will say also, the people who are most ideologically committed to the idea of escapism are also the most practically committed to the exact opposite, doom scrolling. So what are they escaping? They are trying to escape at best their own other behaviors. I'm doom scrolling all day. I'm always online looking at this or that. And often they are doom scrolling, not even about the broader world, the environment, politics, imperialism. They are doom scrolling about their own communities and finding terrors inside those communities. Thus, things like, oh, well, boys liking My Little Pony, that's colonialism. Those settler colonialist bronies. And using this language of political analysis for things that make zero sense as far as the production distribution of mass produced cartoons and things like that. So, sure, I think escapism or doing something other than engaging with a totalizing crypto fascist hyper society is good. Absolutely. But that can happen by doing anything other than engaging with the totality of hyper fascist society. And it doesn't need to be this is escapist and this is not escapist. And certainly we see this with fans of transgressive fiction. Like, oh man, I am reading the transgressive fiction. It's so gross and weird and terrible. And oh, I can take it. I can read to the end of the book. Yeah, who cares? Good for you. You read to the end of a book. My favorite tweet of all time is now long gone, but it survives as a meme screen cap. And I've been trying to avoid meme talk and trying to remove meme turns or phrase from my mind. It is very challenging not to say leopards eating faces in this juncture in the United States. But I'm doing my best. But my favorite meme, which I'll never give up and will always be in my mind, is about some guy. He's like, it's a memoiristic meme. He says, I was in my car with my friend George, and he was listening to Slayer. And I said, these guys aren't so tough or scary. You know why? Because they're singing a little song. And George didn't talk to me for the rest of the trip home. And I always think about that. Oh, look at that guy or that girl. She's writing her little book. Oh, it's so transgressive, that little book. Oh my gosh, they're having sex in the alleyway. Oh, she wrote down the word sex in an alleyway. Oh, that's transgressive. All right. Look at them transgress. So anything can be a kind of escapism because of, anything that isn't direct engagement with what the ideological state apparatus wants you to engage with, which is right now the personalities of Donald Trump and Elon Musk, is escapism. But you can escape with anything. You can escape with your sex in the alley drinking piss book. Or with your, what if Buffy the Vampire Slayer looked like me instead of Buffy the Vampire Slayer? And we were in a kingdom type of book. Both of those are totally acceptable kinds of escapism. And anything can only become escape when we decide to take whatever we have in our cell with us and make a key or make a bludgeon for when the guard comes in or that sort of thing.
One of the things you're talking about is, there is the idea of the hope punk, but there's also this episode about against hope punk. Shouldn't shouldn't publishers encompass sort of both tendencies?
Well, on some level, they must, because there are only five large ones left. And so they do cast very wide nets. But books work differently than, say, films or video games or TV shows, because there are so many more of them. And this is actually a good thing. And people often say, oh, I wish my books were marketed like a film. And I think, not me, because I wouldn't have any books. And Rachel wouldn't have any books. I don't know if you have any books, David, but you still wouldn't have any, because it'll only be 500 books a year. And if you like science fiction, well, you got two. And if you like a cookbook, you got four. And if you liked a book about a sad middle-class man who has an affair with a freshman, and then it comes to the Christmas party at the faculty lounge at the end, and oh my God, his girlfriend and his estranged wife are wearing the same dress. You get three, and that's it. So having books where we have 500,000 books a year is actually great for people who like to write and make living in a shack incomes, but still enjoy expressing themselves and building an audience and having something to say about society. What publishing does, instead of focusing on a few products that everyone's going to watch or everyone's going to consume, is they're production driven. It's a 19th century manufacturing business. So their role is to fill the shelves so that no matter what you buy, Pulp Punk, Grim Dark, Guide to the 50 State Quarters, History of Tim Hortons, whatever, it's one of theirs. This is true to the point where Random House, Macmillan, and I'm absolutely sure without even looking, this is the same in Canada. The major publishers rent their distribution networks to smaller presses. So even your small radical transgressive press, Random House gets a piece, or Macmillan gets a piece, or WW Norton gets a piece. So no matter what you buy, you're buying one of theirs. And the idea of a bookstore having a lot of books is because people want to walk into a bookstore with a lot of books, even though they're all buying largely the same 20% of books. The other 80% are there to make the bookstore look nice. Oh, I've got so many choices, I say as I buy a book about how Trump is bad, or a book about how carbohydrates are bad, or a book about how Jesus is good, or a book about how living in a castle is fun. So yes, they do cover everything, but they cover everything for this reason of accumulating capital, right? That's what capitalism is. It's not really about marketplaces or consumerism. It's about who can have the most capital to activate via some means, whether it's a market mean or a state mean, to get even more capital. So yeah,
Just a
they do
short,
embrace both. Fantastic. Here I am on your podcast. This is all working out.
yeah, I'm sort of not the smartest tool in the shed, but it almost just seems like me, but you guys obviously are already there, is the idea that almost something like a Hope Punk and these kinds of things are just either just specific categories or just a way of marketing something or a place you have something in a bookstore so you know where to go because I want the Hope Punk books. Well, guess what? They're all over here because they're marketing this whole concept of Hope Punk. And if you like this one, you know, that whole idea of, oh, you like this. If you like a swift kick in the nuts, you also like a slap in the face, you know, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. The good thing is that since books are kind of decentralized, and there's so many of them, you can still be a little weirdo on the internet and create your own genre. And sometimes it'll take off, like Hope Punk did. Network connections and fan fiction communities and things like that made it make sense.
I still remain a little bit disappointed that of all of the stupid punk subgenres, salvage punk didn't really take off. And I'm like, I like that. I thought that one was cool. And it's a way less stupid name than noir weird, which
Noir, yes.
noir.
I said it should be weird boiled. That made more sense. That was more zingy, right? Weird boiled, huh? In fact, you can bring it back, Rachel, because your stuff is weird boiled.
Yeah, I mean,
Just say it is. Just say it is. I don't know if it is or not. Just say it.
somebody just get me in touch with China Mieville and we'll hash this out.
Take place in the city of Toronto, and there are weird things happening. There you go.
Sure.
Toronto has shitty weather. Done. Weird boiled it is.
Yeah. I just finished reading 120 Murders a couple days ago. It was wonderful. What do we have to take from dark, cynical stories like that? And why should an optimistic reader take that chance to feel bad now and then?
Well, at some level, it is the escapism, right? It is the escapism of feeling bad for a brief period when nothing bad actually happens to you, or nothing, or none of the bad things that are happening to you are happening to you because something else is happening to you. Certainly, one of the abiding themes of the 21st century is the idea of trauma, and trauma being reflected in fiction, and trauma being motivation for one's behavior and for one's point of view. And sometimes even the replacement of dramatic conflict between people with traumatic conflict within a person that manifests inside a story. But trauma is, by definition, the experience of pain when what is making you experience that pain is not present. That's what trauma is. It is past tense pain in the present. And so a little bit of trauma here and there in small bites can be good. It can just be enjoyable. Like, oh, that was really rough. But oh, it's only a little story. Someone just wrote a little story about it. This is okay. No one's actually dead except for all the dead people in real life. And short fiction, I think, is amenable to the pace of life. I love short fiction. I always have, which is unusual. It's definitely a minority current inside the world of letters. I can still laugh at poets and one-act playwrights, though now I've become a one-act playwright. But short stories really are for the small audience that still likes short stories, which allows you to militate against commercial influence. For some parts, you can get a traumatic experience that is not so heavily commodified as, say, a Hope Punk novel is. And in the case of 120 Murders, they're all about, or all referenced, or all informed thematically or personally by songs you already like, but you don't need to go to Spotify to remember and experience the song anymore. You get a free mental experience after you buy my book. That doesn't also involve using Spotify or Tidal or any of these other systems that pay 0.00012 cents per stream, which is why, for example, I can still enjoy Morrissey. And people say, oh, he's so problematic, he's so awful, he's a fascist. And he's a fascist. He's a disgusting individual. Don't give him any of your money. Well, I'm not. In fact, I don't know how I could. If I listened to Morrissey for the rest of my life, I'd send him $7.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's why God invented torrent so that I could listen to Morrissey guilt-free. So.
I was one of the people who got pegged. I got nailed by the RIAA here in the US.
No.
Where I was, yes. Rachel, you've known me for a long time online, even though we've never actually spoken before today in a real time like this. But don't you remember back in 2004 on my live journal, I posted an article from the Village Voice, and it was my article about my experience getting sued by the RIAA?
I remember that kind of era of
Yes.
people getting hit by that.
I was one of the hit ones. And I wrote this article about my experience about it. And afterward, people said, ah, look, he sold out. This must be part of the settlement where he writes this article saying it's bad or he's sorry. And then people are like, oh, look, he's trying to make his money back by writing an article. Because I had to pay them some money. I had to pay $3,000, which was the second lowest fine. The first lowest was that 12-year-old girl who downloaded a bunch of music. An acquaintance of mine who was a lawyer, a friend of mine who's a lawyer, took the case, and he called in to what was essentially a telemarketing boiler room with other lawyers, and they were just handling these things like you would handle, selling vapes on the phone or something, or selling office supplies on the phone. And they got down to $3,000, and or they began at 3,500. No, we got to go lower. We got to go lower. My friend said, he said, we're not going any lower. My friend said, this guy's a freelance writer. That's all he does. He doesn't have another job. And they said, okay, $3,000. Never mind. They just knew they were not going to get any more out of me than that. There's an example of being semi out of the loop of totalizing publishing industry norms that paid off on some level. That they only paid $3,000 to steal Nas's Made You Look and that book, that one by Sublime, that's always stuck in people's head. It's about summertime or some shit like that. Like all good escapist songs, it's about the weather.
Yeah, see, this is our mistake. We should have thought to download billions of songs at once and sort of regurgitate them into AI pap, and then nobody would be getting sued at all.
That's right. If only we had a business doing that instead of just being
Yeah.
consumers.
But things have changed, certainly. I was wondering, your work and most recent anthology crossed a number of genres from horror to sci-fi, noir. What's the common ground for you as a writer and editor?
Well, partially those are the genres where short fiction is still somewhat vital. In literary fiction, short fiction is most represented in university backstory journals that, by definition, nobody reads because they're university scholarly journals. And nobody reads physics journals or sociology journals or any other kind of scholarly journal for entertainment purposes, or even necessarily at all, unless they're going to use it for their own research, which is what those things are for. But a literary fiction made a dubious Faustian bargain, saying we want jobs for the top 3% of ourselves, and in exchange, we will capture short fiction and make sure nobody reads any. And they went for that. And then they were all turned into adjuncts anyway. But science fiction, fantasy, and horror still have a pretty vibrant short fiction marketplace in that there are a dozen good magazines you can publish in, even if you're a nobody. And a dozen good anthologies that you can publish in, even if you're a nobody. And a bunch of not so good magazines and not so good anthologies you can publish in too. And you can't make a career, you can make a career doing so, but it's a notional career, a career of reputation and occasional several thousand dollars or several hundred dollars here and there. And you can get reprints, and sometimes some dope whose grandmother died says, "Oh, I want to make a movie, but I don't have any ideas," and they'll option your story, that kind of thing. And then crime fiction sort of fits the middle ground between literary fiction and science fiction, fantasy, and horror, in that there are some good venues to publish short crime fiction in, and of course, historically, short crime fiction has been massively influential, Poe and Doyle and that sort of thing. So if you just happen to like short fiction, I just happen to like short fiction. Those genres are the ones to explore and experiment in. And of course, these genre forms are porous, especially horror. Horror is a tone. It is spicy food. You can have a spicy brownie, you can have a spicy taco, you can have a spicy sausage. Crime is a plot. And it can be any kind of plot that involves some kind of social transgression that hints at violation of some law. And that can be a law in the future, it can be a law in the past. It can be a law created by a ghost. And so these all combine. I will say 120 Murders started out as purely crime fiction. My goal was that it was going to be a crime and noir. But as it turns out, in the United States at least, almost every crime and noir anthology one sees is created primarily in-house. And so many of our rejection letters were like, "Wow, this is a great idea. I sure wish I had had this idea so I could do it. Tell us when it's out. I want to read it. Thanks for nothing." And when we did find a publisher, that publisher is a small press called Rouadan Books, was highly interested in what he called the gamut of dark speculation, of dark speculative fiction. So that could be any sort of dark speculative fiction, like dark magical realism. Don't ask me for an example. Dark fantasy, dark science fiction, transgressive fiction noir with a speculative element. And so I opened up my concept for more fantasy, some science fiction, and that sort of thing. We have a story called See America by Todd Grimsom, who was a wonderful writer who isn't as productive as capitalism would want him to be. He published three wonderful novels in the 80s and early 90s. And I encountered him, and he is a very friendly type of guy who will just sort of start messaging you out of the blue. And he started messaging me out of the blue with stories, and one of them fit. And I said, "Oh boy, do you like music?" I said, "I love music." I said, "Good. Can you pretend that you wrote this story after listening to a song and then tell me what the song is?" He said, "No, I can't do that. I love music too much to boil it down to a single song." And so we said he was influenced by the work of Cabaret Voltaire. So we changed the concept. The concept of 120 Murders is one picks a song from the college radio or alternative music video era and is inspired by it on some level, or by the video you saw, or by your experience as a child while listening to it, and you write a story about that. And so we had to change it a little bit, saying, "Oh, you have a story that kind of fits. Please pretend for me that you like music or that you like a certain kind of music." So the concept changed both in expanding genre and in expanding the production process. And this is true of how genres work. Genres are fungible and porous and capacious. Another word that won't help me sell any copies of this book.
No, please, you need to sell copies so that more of this exists. But one of the things that really impressed me is that it's an anthology themed around the last era of music, where you could actually have songs about negative things.
Yes.
Almost universally. And it's not like there's not music out now that I like. I'm determined to not be one of those old people who only listens to things from when I was a teenager. You can't just turn on the radio and hear something sad anymore.
It's true.
Just not there. I mean, I can go to a bookstore still, despite the rise of hope punk, and I can find something that's going to make me feel sad. Thankfully, we have a wonderful tradition in this country of writing almost exclusively depressing novels.
It's the
But
prairie, right? It's that prairie makes you sad.
it's the prairie and the history of genocide. That's what does it, you
Yeah.
know? And the fact that it's cold almost all of the time. But, you know, I don't see that happening in music anymore. And that was why the second you announced this, I'm like, oh no, I am gonna love this. Because this is just this weird little quirk of an era where you could have sad music about bad things.
And you can find it. That's the thing, right? Now radio stations are conglomeratized, and there was happening in the 80s too. They were firing DJs and saying, oh, we could just program music, or maybe we could get rid of music, and we can get rid of unusual formats. I mean, the create when album-oriented rock moved to classic rock, that says we're going to stop adding new music. That was the death knell creatively of radio, at least in the US. And I would be surprised if it was not the same in Canada, except perhaps Canada has the mandated CanCon,
We do still
Canadian
have
CanCon. Yeah,
mandated
I too have mandated CanCon. Like my friend Jason, you better write something. I need a Canadian in this.
CanCon.
He wrote about the Replacements. Everyone I tried to peg for demographic reasons said, I'm not doing demographic stuff. I'm writing some crazy song you never heard of. But of course, there's enormous amounts of sad music and horrifying music out there that you have to find the hard way via algorithmic processes. So the kind of discovery is no longer there. I've got a kid now, and I remember a few years ago when he was learning how to type and looking at computers and things, he said, oh, I'm going to do something cool. I said, what are you going to do? I'm going to Amazon.com and I'm going to type in cool stuff and see what you can buy me. He said, well, I'm not buying you anything from Amazon. But he typed in cool stuff, and like a bunch of random shit came up. He said, look, it is all cool. It works. The internet works. You can type in cool stuff and do that. But you can't really do that with music, at least not in a way that is effective. And I listen to music constantly online. I'm constantly streaming this or that thing, usually like DJ mixes and EDM and shoegaze compilations. And I'm just studying it. And I have to stop and say, wait, that was a song I want to hear more than once and write it down. Just like I was a teenager listening to college radio and saying, what was that? Please come back, stumbling, stammering DJ. He doesn't know how to be a DJ. And tell me what those 14 songs were. So that mode of discovery is gone. And because it's gone, there's no impulse to try to create it for a mass audience. And the music industry has destroyed itself right there. The music industry is now a licensing industry for the most part. They're not interested in launching new acts or new sounds. They're interested in selling and reselling Bob Dylan's music like they're NTFs. So it's extremely challenging. And that is also one reason why this 120 Words is in a small press, a small startup press. We're like the second book they're doing. And it came from a Facebook conversation. The guy, the publisher said, oh, Nick, do you want to write a story for my anthology? I said, sure do. I said, oh, you're doing publishing? Yeah, I'm doing publishing. I'm doing anthologies. You think Ellen Datlow will want to work with me? I said, I think I want to work with you. Or at the very least, myself. I said, you should probably try me before you try Ellen Datlow, who's an extremely famous anthologist. To the extent that anyone can be an extremely famous anthologist, she's an extremely famous anthologist and quite busy and doesn't suffer fools gladly in a beginning level. And I love the small press and I love sort of just thrashing around with small books. So it's, for me, it's more fun. So here we all are on our small podcast talking about our small book of small stories that make us feel small, sad feelings.
Yeah, which segues in perfectly to what small obscure projects is everybody working on?
You tell me, Rachel, what are you working on?
My new book is out, Light, which is incredibly depressing. And the first book, Cascade, has many wonderful blurbs, including from yourself. But the one that we almost put on the cover was from Peter Watts, and it was finally something to make the Hope Punk shut the fuck up. I would say that Blight is a little bit more cheerful, but not really by much. So that is out. That is available for you to buy and hold with your greedy little hands. As well, there should be another story of mine floating around with Troll Breath magazine, another small upstart publishing enterprise called Do You Love the Color of the Sky? And I am working on one or two new Sad Bastard cookbooks. So there should
Oh, wonderful. I
there's
love the Sad Bastard cookbook especially. I
yeah.
think that book is hilarious and it looks beautiful. One of the good things about conglomerization is it gave us all the tools to do things to make a book that looks as good as a book that you can find in a store from a major publisher. Of course, that's only potential. You have that skill to do it. Most people can spot a small press book a mile away. So it's really a good achievement that the Sad Bastard cookbook looks so great and is so great and is so funny. And I'm getting a second copy of it for my son who's 11 and is expressing an interest in cooking, but also in not having very flavorful meals, like in very simple things he likes because he's a kid in his bikini. It's like, oh, here's how you make a pancake. Here's how you make an egg. You can take a pickle out of a fridge. So back in April, we were all there for the launch party. It was amazing. Three cities in one day, flew from town to town. 120 Murders came out. By the way, did you know who's in this book, Rachel? Canned content. Silvia Moreno Garcia has a story in this book.
Oh, I sure know that. That was my favorite
That's right. Big deal. Old pal of mine got her start as an anonymous commenter on my live journal. Look at her now. Look at me now. Paul Tremblay is in the book. He's got a story about a pizzeria that doesn't take cards. He had to get his revenge on the pizzeria. That was his motivation. Kara Hoffman, famous anarchist thriller writer, writing about a dumpy ass town in the middle of New York, which is every dumpy ass town in New York. We have Meg Gardner, the crime novelist, and mystery novel thriller novelist. Work by Molly Tanzer, a big honking novelette about a college radio DJ and a prank war and murder. And I'm in that story because the
Yes,
story's about me asking her for the story.
you get
So I
to
guess the story actually happened, or maybe one thing didn't quite happen the way it was supposed to. I have Alex Jennings, a great writer whose first novel was very musical, and he's deeply musical. He is the one guy who pitched me a song I had never heard before as his motivation. He stumped me. He stumped the editor. We had Tom Gribson, who we talked about before, and many, many others. And they all explain, they have little notes about where they were when they first heard their song or what motivated them. We have Jeffrey Ford, one of my favorite writers. And this is a great story. I said, oh, so Jeff, do you like this kind of music? He said, what are you talking about? I said, okay, here are three songs. Pick one and pretend you like it. And so if you ever see Jeff Ford, make sure to ask all about Black Flag. He's a huge fan of Black Flag, especially the Henry Rollins vocalist era. He'll answer all your trivia questions with a what the fuck are you talking about?
Incredible.
Incredible. Also coming, I have a short crime comic script in the anthology of comics, short comic book stories, Perfect Crime Party. And it is called the 21-foot rule. You know what the 21-foot rule is?
I do not know what the 21-foot rule is.
It is a racist police gambit that gives them ideological cover for shooting people. In that, within 21 feet, the police say, a knife beats a gun. That is, I can pull out my knife and rush up to you and stab you if I'm within 21 feet of you before you can pull your gun and shoot me. And that is why police often say, oh, I had to shoot him. I thought he had a knife. But he was 20 feet away, exactly. And I wrote a story about this a few years ago. It was published in a prose version of it in a first volume of a small press magazine called Dark Yonder, number one. And I recreated it as a comic book script. And my friend and coworker at my day job, Jules Valera, a wonderful artist out of Glasgow, Scotland, did all the art and all the lettering. And that's coming out. And in September, if we have a September, my next novel is coming out from a small press called Clash Books, a small press that has made its way, climbed its way up to being a medium-sized press. And this is why I've got a career, because the editors and publishers and founders of that press read my first novel 20 years ago when they were teenagers and said, oh, wow, I want to do this. And they were fans of me for whatever reason. And I am like the Velvet Underground of that. Nobody bought my record, but everyone who bought the record got involved in music. And the same with me. Nobody bought my first novel, but everyone who bought it said, I'm going to ruin my life and become an editor, a writer, or a publisher. And
Called out because I bought your first novel.
there you go. Yeah, and now look at you. You have me on your podcast. And so the book should be called, if the springtime me is lucky and persuasive, Kalivas, Kalivas, exclamation point, another tempest. And it is a modern dress or postmodern dress version of Shakespeare's The Tempest taking place in a future where everyone but the Caliban character, the titular Calavas, is a kind of futuristic post-human cyborg. That is why they have the magic powers of Prospero, etc. And Calavas is the last free-range human. But publishing being what it is, this past week, the distributor consortium, they even called themselves consortium, which is amazing. It's like calling yourself McEvil. Said, can we change the title? And I said, then said, what do you want to change it to? We want to change it to the last free-range human. And I thought, I was shocked at how terrible an idea that was, because that doesn't sound like a novel. That sounds like Robert F. Kennedy's next book about not eating his Skittles because it got red dye in them. And so this book might be called The Tempest with a Three instead of an E. That was my thing. I said, what would these people want from me? How about The Tempest with a Three? Or the T3 Pest, as I've been calling it in my mind. But anyway, in September, look for a book by me about The Tempest. Just type in Mama Das Tempest book, please, into Google. It'll pop, whatever it's called, it'll pop up. And
Awesome.
finally, at some point in the future, I'm working on this now. I'm writing a book about Ursula K. Le Guin's fiction and the anarchist and Taoist elements in her fiction. And it is taking me a long time because every 2 months, somebody puts out another Omelas fix-it story. For the two of you who don't know, not you two on this podcast, but the two of you in the audience who don't know, The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas is a very famous story by Le Guin, which is about a utopia that is somehow fueled by the degradation of a young child in a closet. And some people don't like that kind of thing, and they walk away from Omelas. And this has aggravated people for 40 years. And for whatever reason, in the past 15 years or so, someone every couple of months says, you know what? I'm going to fix this story. How dare that Le Guin do this? I'm going to rescue that fucking baby. Or I'm going to have another town with another baby being tortured. And I'm going to make that baby better. Or I'm going to go in there and heal the baby, give the baby a hug, or all this fucking garbage. And so the Omelas 4 pages, half a chapter, has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. Because whenever I said, okay, this chapter's in bed, another asshole rolls out with another fucking Omelas fix it story. It might just end up being an Omelas book, honestly. We'll see what happens. That's what I'm up to. David?
I'm not going quite at warp nine at the moment. So I'm recently retired and I'm taking that literally and figuratively. I'm trying to break into being, the science fiction, fantasy, horror, short story writer. So I've been in a group for about 5 years. I've got about 15, 20 stories, and they're getting to a point. I've been in poetry for like 30 years and I've written at a very high level, but fiction is such a different animal. Just trying to get the writing done and send it out and see what happens.
You should take my class. I got an online class in April. You should take it. For everyone else listening to this podcast in June, take my class sometime. Maybe November. We'll see when I feel like doing it again.
We'll talk because that
All right, sounds good.
sounds good.
All right. So thank you so much for joining us. And where do people find you online?
Right now, the only place you can find me online that if you're a stranger is Blue Sky. At
Yeah.
and Mama Tas. That is MAMA, like Mama, T as in Thomas, AS, all the vowels are A's. As I say to every telemarketer I've ever called, and Mama Tas at Blue Sky. I'm on Facebook. Don't try to friend me. I mean, you can try to friend me, but honestly, if you are a guy whose picture is of you wearing a hat and you got a beard, I cannot tell you apart from anybody else, so I will not refriend you. You can send me a little note or you can take off your fucking hat. That's all I got. And, haven't updated my live journal in 4 years. It's not going to be updated anymore. Pretty much off Twitter. I only stay on there to see if the Elon Musk screen caps are real or fake. Often they're fake. And they don't need to be. He has a lot of insane tweets that doesn't, you don't need to be creative about them to try to smear him. He is a self-smearing machine. So Blue Sky it is, or my website, which I've not updated in 4 years either, but will probably be updated by June 2025, I hope. Nick-mamatas.com.
Amazing. Well, this is so much fun in a feel bad kind of way.
All right. Thank you so much for having me and continued success to you, Rachel. Good luck with your retirement, David.
Yes, and to you as well. And everybody, go buy 120 Murders. It's
That's
fantastic.
right. Keep your heads down and your hands up.
Wizards and Spaceships is a Nightbeats production. It's written and produced by David L. Klink and Rachel A. Rosen. Our theme music is by Rick Innes. You can find more of his music at Anything That Grooves on SoundCloud. Our logo is by Martin Knorr. See more of his work at Flower Prince Draws on Instagram. Our sound bites are from Pixabay. At least half of our dad jokes are by Rohan O'Doyle. You can find show notes, other episodes, and links to our other projects at wizardsandspaceships.ca.